you all for coming. I know it's colder than it was last week. Everybody's so busy. It's such a busy month. There's like four conferences. I've missed all of them because I just didn't organize for this. And so I thank you for taking the time out and coming. The original point of this was knowledge sharing from based on my two-year project that I'm working on. But then I decided to expand it because I had the money to invite people like Kate Paul and Lindsay and Valley to, you know, share their home construction knowledge, share their understanding of the new regulations of the EU and things. So I decided to shift the event to have 2 days, and the days actually got flipped when I discovered that MPs told me that we have meetings on Monday the whole day, so we would never be able to attend on a Monday. So we put education on the Monday. So this morning session is about trying to discuss about building bridges between educators, principals, administrators, and community members, and how we value knowledge, and how we do knowledge, and how we do theory, and how we can apply it. The second, the afternoon session will be run by Kate and Valley, and that's on co-production and collaborative technology. And then tomorrow we have community event. It's on community outreach, NGOs, working with youth, working with activists, and working with policymakers. And we've got some MPs coming. The mayor was too busy, but the mayor's assistant will make that appearance. And Sadi and Kate will be presenting to how that works. That works well with the community. And then in the afternoon, the session, Sirpa will lead with Valley and Kate again about how to figure out these new rules and regulations with the GDPR and the understanding privacy and ethics and data. So that's kind of the two-day event, and there'll be different participants at different times and everything. So welcome, everybody. And so we do have to wait till about quarter after because, Petri, there's pull out and coffee if you want to get. Okay. I'm going to go first so I can get over. I'm going to go first because mine is more of a practical nature. A lot of people that are in this room have seen me present at Paul regarding everyday cultural practices, so it's the same presentation except the focus and the perspective of the presentation. And this is this presentation has been adapted to look at how we can practically, in a practical sense, have teachers understand how they can use these videos and these artifacts and these co-produced arts projects that are done in after-school programs to enable teachers to better understand fully students' needs. The second presentation will be by Lindsay, and it is an amazing, I've seen the PowerPoint slides. You're too modest. It's just really, really interesting on human rights and Islamophobia and racism in educational institutions and everything. It's really good. So we're about almost at the quarter after, so I will start. I don't have a flipper, so I'm going to have to. Just to let you know, in case you thought I'm really bad at spelling, this is in Finnish and in English. And it's not just Google Translated, but I have to look at it to make sure it was okay.
Well, it looks like I haven't looked at it all, but
Oh, hey, wait a minute.
I'll explain if there's some errors.
As we all know about translation and language, trying to get the idea is what is the most important. So I'm looking at an after-school project that I've had. It's a session of it. This is a two-year project, and we have four sessions. Presently finishing off the second session, working with elderly and refugees, making food stories, and rap artists, and graffiti artists now, and animators, and 13-year-old girls. And then the next year we're going to be working with preschool and elder and seniors, telling stories about the past to try to share historical stories to the children, taking those stories then and having vocational schools, children, the age 16, 17, 18, those students make a graphic novel or animation from these various stories. So those are in the next. But this would be just be concentrating on the first session that we did. And it was with preschool and primary school children. It was an after-school program in Kansas. And we worked with an Iraqi refugee filmmaker and their children and volunteer Finnish teachers and master student teams. It was a lot of fun. So the study was, we wanted to create opportunities for teachers and parents and students to understand not just the task of creating a story that gets done in these classrooms, but how kind of everyday kind of cultural practices can become and are important learning. Nice email. Apologize for that. And this was done in a very, you know, multi-sensory, multimodal way. They created movies, but at the same time they created the props, the characters, they did live action, the sound effects. So they were really working with a lot of different types of competences. And we wanted to highlight with these videos to show that learning does not just, it's not just situated in an institution, that there is real 21st century learning occurring in these after-school programs that gets overlooked by principals and teachers for whatever various reason. I think I have to stay back here. And so the question was, like, where and how is knowledge constructed? And for the last 40 years or so, you know, there's been lots of research, as we all know, in the area of literacy and language, and, you know, saying that there's two spheres of influence, you know, your home and school, and you all, we hear that from Heath and Kate and everybody talk about it, but we don't see it as applied as much in classroom settings. We don't see that the teachers, the application of bridging between home and school. We hear there's a lot of research on it, but not a lot of work on it. And so this study is highlighting how we can do it, how we can actually fly across spaces from the informal and home to the formal. So I took everyday cultural practices rather than, because I wanted to differentiate from anything that might be construed as classroom practices, classroom homework, classroom activities, drawing a picture, making a story. A lot of those same kind of practices get done in school. So I wanted to differentiate between school-based or school-like tasks and actual tasks you can do with your parents and your family that get done every day. So learning about and with and from each other. I have a background in theater, and so most of my activities that I do tend to be very, I guess some of my colleagues would say, creative. And so I like looking at the different forms of creativity, and not just the traditional forms of coloring a picture or painting, but small little things like, you know, knitting or making stories up from, you know, finger puppets or anything like that. So just the small things that we do, everyday movement. So creativity in this project, we were looking at creativity and emotions and how they intersect. That the idea of a lot of your creativity comes from prior learning from the home, and so your emotional memory and identity to those practices that are done with your grandparents or your aunts and uncles, and how that connects to your learning later on. And so because also the project we were looking, the group of kids in the project were preschool, kindergarten age 4, 5, 6. We had grade 1 and 2. We had grade 3 and grade 4.
And because of the wide age range, and you know, you had girls and boys, and you had, so these different emotions were coming into play when they were negotiating and working in groups, that is sometimes often forget in the learning process, that we have to mediate our emotions and how we view things and how we see certain colors and shapes, as well as how we're feeling from whatever reason in the background, and how that affects learning. So, and how it affects participation on an emotional level. The scaffolding is not just the mediation of knowledge, but it's also the mediation of caring between people and working through a problem and negotiating in a careful manner. So these shared experiences and types of particular experience created engagement. And that's one thing we noticed, that the young, the old, the boys, the girls, everybody was engaged and working together in a meaningful manner. So I kind of had two research questions. How do these artistic materials provide for diverse cultural resources for meaning-making in a changing world? And how can this co-production process enable institutional stakeholders to bridge with community stakeholders? So my research design was going under the assumption that when we talk about knowledge and learning and meaning-making, that we're sharing and negotiating. So if that is the case in the classroom, and that's the case in life, that our research practices then must mirror this. We cannot have a separated research practices that don't mirror the kind of learning that's going on. Otherwise, there's a disconnect in what we're understanding and that is occurring in the process. And so we allowed the students to film. So we would film the whole overall scene, and then we also had a video camera where the students got to film whenever they wanted individual sections. And we have nice data of the floor being filmed or people's feet being filmed just because that's what they wanted to film at the time. And I look at it as breaking down what I call the fourth wall. Because of my theater background, that Diderot's, you know, metaphor of the fourth wall that divides the audience from the actors. And in co-production, and if you really wanted any kind of ethnographic research, it would be nice to tear down this fourth wall so that we are the actors as well as the researchers, and they are the researchers as well as the actors. So there is no level, there's no objectivity, it's all subjectivity together. And this arts-based project allowed using arts and using videos. They were, these kids, some of them came from different linguistic backgrounds. They were able to discuss through what they made and through visual images that they were able to construct together. So it was a much more inclusive process. And they created the whole film, so it really was on them.
Can I interrupt here? Nothing. Ei mitään vaarallista, mutta huomasin, että tässä esitelmässä on joitain kohtia, jotka on vielä sen vanhalle Google Translateille, että se ei ole tähän saakka. Mennyt ne mukaan.
I'm the queen of Google Translate.
Yeah, just explain them that there are some bits that are still the old Google Translate stuff, so it looks weird. Sorry. Pyydän anteeksi. Yeah, it's funny.
Sarah's like going, yeah. Nope. Yeah. Nettie did this line. Not it.
Yeah. I did translate them all, but for some reason they are not in this presentation.
Oops. Oh my gosh. Okay. Interesting. Don't know how that happened. Okay. Sorry. So when you come across these kind of processes and problems, you've got to learn to overcome them. So co-constructing arts provides all learners, regardless of their competence and their age, because like I said, we had a little preschool girl from Cameroon who spoke English, but she spoke very little Finnish. So we had other kids who actually were very strong Finnish speakers, but also spoke English, so they kind of helped each other out, and that was really good. And so we wanted the kids to realize that, and we want the teachers to realize that all kinds of modes and communication modes are valuable. That the visuals, the the whole process, and you'll see in the video, the actual process became more meaningful, them doing it and working it out, because it was such a multimodal way that they were working. It's quite neat to see them. And so this kind of empowered their voices, because they got to choose everything. They really did. I hired the filmmaker, and I thought he was going to come in, and he was going to do the filming, and they were just going to tell him what. But that's not what happened. He just, you know, gave them the camera. They chose the scenes. They chose the dialogue. They wrote everything. So it enables the creation of a new shared community experience and a new identity. So what we discovered that, so for educators and teachers who worry about this, I mean, Finland is the best incubation place to do this, because first, it's one of the few countries that has multiliteracies embedded in their K-12 curriculum. It's in the curriculum. It's part of their curriculum. The other thing is, this is the country that does not, they don't do testing unless it's the final year. They don't believe in homework and tests and assignments like that. So if you want to view 21st century learning, competences, real lifelong learning, this would be the ideal place. However, the bureaucracy doesn't quite allow them to engage in that yet. So we have to figure out ways to highlight, because the original point of this study was going to be working with teachers and Finnish second language teachers and helping them design programs to enable them to attain their outcomes using different creative methods. It was too much work. How are we gonna test this? How are we gonna assess this? And so we were like, really? Okay. So but the good thing was we were able to do this after school program, and now I have a lot of data that shows that I can sit down with the principals and the teachers and say, look at this learning that's occurring. It's not just skill based learning. This is actual competencies of how to, you know, use a video camera, how to negotiate in a group. This is what we do in life, in real jobs, adult jobs. You sit there in a group and you collaborate and you negotiate what you guys want. So this is, hopefully we can convince policymakers for that. So what they learned was narrative design, story construction, and not only did they create the characters, create the dialogue, write the dialogue both in Finnish, and then we help them translate into English as well. Videotape it, do the acting. We had a big group at first, and we had three stories. We had the Candyland story with the evil witch, we had the alien egg story, and we had the SpongeBob story, because they were given just a theme of food practices, and you decide what you want. So we had a large enough group, and because you had boys and girls and older kids and younger, you have these three very divergent stories, and we started them off by letting them to assemble their stories, and then we realized we wouldn't have enough time to make all three movies. So we said, let's collaborate, and the numbers fell a bit, so we said, let's collaborate together and make one story. And they had to synthesize, and they did themselves, synthesize what aspects they wanted from what story, which characters, and in what scene. So it was wonderful to see them be able to collaborate on this, and the character development and collaboration. So utilizing multimodal communication modes was one of the key things, and it's really nice to see. So here, now I do apologize, because I should have edited the film better, but it was a little rushed in terms of time and trying to play with the videos in the PowerPoint. So ignore the first, like, 20 seconds of the video. We want to look at the girl in the second part of the video. And you're going to see how they negotiate character development. So they're all working in different desks and different groups. And these two girls were drawing the characters. This is when they were... Oh, that one doesn't work. That's okay. Everybody look there. So they were making the characters in the scene and who would have to be... Because we were getting them to storyboard it at the time. There were six scenes to the movie. And in a moment, you're going to see the... She's a volunteer drama teacher. So she's explaining the characters to the teacher and letting them know what's going on there. Yes, and then here's where they had story construction. So we had a lot of scenes where they made a lot of stuff for backdrops because they originally were having three movies, and then because we compressed the movies, they ended up getting rid of some of this stuff. So these little girls are both in grade one. And they're speaking in Finnish, even though they both speak really good English. So you're going to see here... They're really good friends, and they know each other. And they have... And it was Easter time, so we brought these Easter stickers because they were selling them. And they have a really cute moment where they're, so this is supposedly for Candyland. So they have three houses in Candyland. But even though they were in charge of different jobs, they decided who was going to do what. She's doing all the gluing and the glitter and everything. And she's doing all the stickers. They're still collaborating as to which sticker to choose and where to put the sticker. So there was not a... I'm going to do it wherever I want to. And there was a lot of negotiation going, well, do you think that it's good over here? And in one sec, I apologize, but we're going to get to... When you look at this... Agreeing where they put the sticker, that's the best place to put the sticker. And so, I apologize that it was such a long thing, I wasn't able to cut it. And this one is where narrative, so this is where they actually have to mix the three stories together, and they're deciding what goes in what scene, and what is being left out. So they've decided, and he's the filmmaker, and so they're actually explaining to the filmmaker how they want the scene and what characters they want in the scene and which ones they don't want in the scene. As you see, sometimes they filmed things they might not have wanted to film. So it was the new scene because they had to make one story. So they were explaining to the filmmaker what they had to do for that scene and how they had to shrink to the new scene. So the final movie included a wide age range. It included boys and girls, different linguistic backgrounds and home practices, different stories they had to synthesize. And so it had a lot of interesting when you see the final product. Now, in this scene, when I first watched the video, I thought, oh, we didn't really get capture them actually making the footprint part of the movie. And so I'm going to start playing it. But the negotiation that's quite interesting here is really multimodal negotiation, because towards the middle part of it, first you have people from different backgrounds trying to figure out how to explain to the kids how to use the video camera. And they were getting confused that red means stop and green means go, but it actually green means stop and red means go. So that was a confusion with the teachers and the filmmaker, and he was going to try to explain to the girls who are going to videotape. They have to have footprints to go for the portal because it has an alien aid thing. And this scene where the girls end up, and then later on they're going to choose which footprints, because they filmed the footprints several times, and they're going to choose which footprints, and they want to know how do we edit them and how do we put them together and everything, which when you think of it in terms of grade 1, 2, and 3, that's really advanced multimodal kind of competencies they're learning themselves, you know. So this is something that they can use later on in their work skills. It's not something just that they're learning as a classroom thing that will then later on forget. And actually, she'll do the filming, but then the other kids come together and they are choosing together on the scenes, which is a really nice... So it was never just up to one person. It was always the filming and everything was chosen and discussed as a group. Here's where they... And the other kids in the corner are actually doing the sound... Originally, we're doing the sound effects, and then they were going to film the next scene, which was the egg. So here's where they all come together, and they start to choose which scenes that they're going to... And so now the final product, after all that, you get to see. And remember, they chose everything. I think it's not long enough. So the students ate the candy and they lost their memory. the eggs that they make the humans eat the candy, and we will eat them. So I love the fact that carrot, healthy food, and water will get their memory back. That was their decision. They have to go through a portal. Going to tell the adults. The adults don't believe that he's got his gun and he's taking it. So it was kind of, it was very much constructive interaction rather than just, you know, social interaction where they acquired a lot of skills and a lot of 21st century competence. They really were, because they built it themselves. And so to me, showing educators that, look, it's the process that they went through that is the most important, not just the final skill that is so useful for, especially in Finland, where multiliteracy is part of the curriculum. And that they created something new from their different backgrounds and something, you know, that was very different from typical book, textbook learning. And it was more, you know, things that would connect to their home environment. There we go. Okay. So for teachers, I find that if we can show them these videos and show them how to... Even if you have to say, look, here's your learning outcomes, here's how this surpasses your learning outcomes, here how this helps them not just for skill-based but for competence, that we have to push away from this idea that learning is just a skill, but it's actually, we have to understand that it's a collaborative competence, that we work together. That ability to work together and negotiate is, to me, the best skill that teachers can teach kids. Yes, so... Do you have any questions? Or I'd like to open it up to discussion because I would like to have us discuss about, do you face the same experiences and frustrations as researchers where you do these wonderful after-school projects and then how can apply to there? Or don't know how to work around the bureaucracy or the curriculum to get it to apply? And I'm just wondering what we can do in the future.
I think it's all very nice, but I'm also very much interested because you presented like I think it's a very nice project and everything is going very nicely. But I would also be very much interested in how the kids negotiate themselves, asymmetries, power, all these aspects, because I think they play a vital role when they are interacting with each other. And I think it's very nice, but I think it's also kind of difficult to idealize the world that where these kids live in, because it's not equality, it's not always
It wasn't. Right. No. And that's why I talk about the emotionality, because these girls were very bossy. And it was the age of the bossy girl in grade 3, where they were like, there was another boy from grade 4 and he dropped out. And I believe that it was because of these girls going, no, we're going to do it this way. And you're like, ah. So I think you're right. I think that, yes, that is. I'm showing you the best highlights of the project. And there's hours and hours and hours of videotapes because it was over 2 months. And it's true. There was, you know, we had even younger kids, like the little Syrian girl, her younger brother came. And after a few times, he kind of dropped out because he was bored and it was harder for him. And he didn't speak much Finnish. And it was... You know, to always just follow your sister around. And there were differences between the bossy girls, I guess I like to call them, and the more compliant girls, and how do they, you know, and the Cameroon girl, that she didn't speak that much Finnish, so it was much harder for her.
I just, thanks, that's really interesting. I think sometimes as well when you've got a project-based learning, it's really good to have, the process is really important, but it's also really good to have something they're aiming towards, so sort of maybe a festival where they're sharing things or doing things or performing, because you do have all these concepts as they're developing. So for instance, we had a big digital storytelling project and there were a group who were, they just didn't know how to work together and found it really hard, and they were aged between 10 to 14, so they were across the ages. It was after school clubs that they wanted to be there. And there was one child who was quite autistic as well, but they were working with animation, and so the autistic child could not do everything himself that he wanted to. And there was a lovely moment in the filming where he had to give instructions to the other child in order to make his part work. And so for the first time, he suddenly realised that by giving quite clear instructions, the other person had to follow them and then do them. So that, you know, in terms of, and that's what they found from the project. They had a lovely story by the end of it, but it was those negotiations that they found really hard.
Yeah.
And they did it. And for and another Bulgarian performance, that's a after school Saturday, group of 10-year-olds, they went off, well, it was a mixed group as well. But because there weren't any adults sort of telling them you've got to kind of do this and this, and they had to get this film done, they just said, you know, we all worked together, we listened to each other's ideas, it became a lovely big cake that we, you know, made. And they really thought about how they wanted to present it at different times.
Yeah, I know, I agree with that, because I had such a, let's, like I'm a teacher, and originally I had structured it with vocabulary and with pictures, etc., and so they could learn the word strong and hero, etc. And then I pulled back and said, like, let's just let them do what they want to do. So I did that, but the biggest conflict was with the teachers who were volunteering, because they were like, going, this is just not professionally done, it's not structured, it's, I'm like, you know what? Because we're not selling it, so whatever they create is what they will learn from it. And I think I think difficulty overcoming the problem is a better learning than having everything perfect and being able to color. So I think I agree with you, but I think that's the point. Yeah, that's the point. Yeah, let me, you know. So yes. Anybody else have after school kind of programs where they?
Yeah, we have an after school program. Where we're doing video as well with secondary school students. And I'm thinking about your question of how you I think the teachers really need to be part of the whole process of setting the objectives of what we're doing. We want that to happen.
Well, see, what my question here was that the teachers didn't want to participate. They didn't mind us doing it in school, but they didn't want to actually have to take the time to help out because that was extra time and burden for them. And that's where I find it. So it's if they can't participate due to constraints of time, then fair enough, everybody can live their life. So how do we overcome that then? How can we still use these projects to get them to understand and learn and make them learn the process that these kids are learning and developing? So how do we...
No, so it was... Can you hear me now?
Yeah, perfect. Thank you so much.
Just following on from what Emily was saying and in response to your question. So I'm in an earlier stage, really, than you and Emily in setting up a project that I'll be
working with young people and creative practitioners. And the process, I've kind of set into the project design a long lead-in to actually work and develop the relationships with the schools and the teachers. So we'll be working with four schools, two in Manchester and two in Leeds. And it's a big concern for me as to how to negotiate this, because in the UK, I imagine it's the same across all contexts, in the UK teachers are under so much pressure and have so much on their plates in terms of attainment, and there isn't, I know my project will be an additional project for the school and for the young people. So I'm trying to, in the project design, I also embedded kind of how this relates to particular attainment targets that the school will have across different subjects and how it fits with other areas of the curriculum in terms of citizenship. So in that case, it kind of attempts to release some of the burden from the teachers and actually shows them how this fits within what they need to do, because it is a huge, where I am in the UK, you know, anything extra has to be really embedded in the school to get that buy-in at the beginning.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I had done a similar project in Kazakhstan where we worked with the teachers with the what's the curriculum for each grade, what's the learning outcomes expected of each, and then we created a project where they were using the learning outcomes of the curriculum of the teachers. So there was nothing that was it didn't, you know, put too much pressure, and they were able to use those videos, et cetera, and the things they created as assessment tools. It wasn't the case here in Finland. They weren't. They just kind of didn't want to have to deal with, you know, conflicting with the curriculum. I was like, okay. But I mean, maybe over time, if they continue to see these kinds of projects, maybe then it's exposure. You know, the more they see how valuable this could be, the more they're willing to allow you to come in and work with you. So, yeah. And Dimitri, I want to do as well. Oh, yeah, the mic, sorry.
I guess it's easier to start with me then. I could see a lot of links, even though I don't do, like, you know, the extracurricular part, but I try to do participatory research. And I see there are two parts to that problem. One is teachers are seeing that being something extra, so you can't really expect them. Like, I was lucky to have teachers who are really enthusiastic and ready to cooperate, and I still do with them. But you can't kind of take it for granted, because that's your work, what you do. That's not their work. So I guess one sort of group of stakeholders that you should sort of communicate the project results and whatever is the school administration as well, in a way. Not just the teachers themselves, because this is so lovely that you show that they have their own job and have their own lives as well. So, and but you're right in that sense that having more of those and being able to show how it works, and of course linking that to the curriculum, is I think really essential, at least at the starting point. So, yeah, there.
My turn. Yeah, for me it really points to the importance of the value of an ethnographic approach in this sort of research, but also the idea that an ethnographic principle of prolonged engagement, which starts a long time before the project begins. So the time spent developing relationships with, for example, teachers and school administrators, even before you submit the bid for the project, is part of the process. And developing it's not just sort of negotiating access and getting sort of teacher buy-in. It's more profound than that. It's more sort of personal and human than that. It's about developing relationships. So the ethnographic warrant and the warrant for ethnography, I think, is provided there.
No, I completely agree. I was bound by the time constraints that here's the money, it's coming now, and you hold it for 2 years, and you have to spend it. You can't put my... So I had to cut to my piece rate. That was my issue. I couldn't build that, which I agree with you. I would love, you know, I would tell you to do, but, you know, go in, volunteer, get to know the classroom. That's what I mentioned.
So I suppose that's a broader question about how can we enable or support the greater valuing of ethnographic research and ethnographic models within the sort of the bureaucracies and the structures which provide funding for our work.
Just hold it.
Yeah. Yes, thank you for that. I think the thing that I'm struggling with, and this is coming on from both of your questions, is who's co-producing with who. And I guess we're doing a project in a school where the layers are really hard. So you could co-produce with the school, which is what we've ended up doing, but with the higher level. And then the teachers don't have a clue what we're doing. Or you could co-produce with the children for a day, which is what we also did. So we co-produced and the children made a film for a day, but they had no clue before that day as to what our project was about. Or you could start the entire project with the entire stakeholders devising the project. And I guess we've got to get a bit more savvy about saying, you know, where are the layers of co-production? And it's making me think about my own projects. It's really, really helpful, Nettie, that you're showing. But I also do think there's something about being honest about the level at which we're working and seeing that level embedded in the process of analysis and data. So recognising those kids, probably the ways in which they're understanding their work and the through line for them and thinking about their through line and their ownership of the project. So I guess it's just that those layers of co-production that I wanted to really raise and think about. And I know I'm equally traumatized in a way by how little children have agency over their own decision making, particularly in the UK context. So it kind of brings that up for me.
No, I agree with you. Like this project actually,
the realization that we've got to work at all, like you're saying, at all levels. We have to not just treat it as, well, this is a classroom project, or this is an after-school project, or this, we have to start like working completely together on all levels. The parents as well, getting the parents to see, you know. We tried to get the parents to come to the, we presented the movie. They were unable because it was a work day, et cetera. So, I mean, that's another thing, is how do we get the community completely involved? That, so that the schools are not going, oh, I've got to, you know, do the testing, but they see that as, oh, this is part of what schools are. We build bridges between communities and parents, and this is, you know. And I agree with you. I think the how do we ensure that all the levels are met?
I mean, one thing that I think about this room project, and I think it might be useful, is ways of which language, multilingual projects can kind of bring in different kinds of understanding, so parents actually know a language better than teachers, and that is one way to lead their knowledge.
I'm fine. Thank you, Nettie. And that was a perfect bridge over to my question, multilingualism and the language issues. So how did you, you're an English speaker, not very well, you know some Finnish. So how, could you just mention something about your role? Can you just mention something about your role and how you, how it worked?
Way of negotiating. I was relying on children. In some sense, because a few of the grade one children were Syrian and she was born here, but Indonesian parents, so one spoke, they both spoke Finnish. One had come over here later, but they both spoke English as well. And so they were the translators sometimes, in some cases, but there was also, we had master students, but they were not as proficient in Finnish, but we had
as well as we had one teacher assistant who, her English was not so good, but her Finnish was great. And so, you know, so it was a real multilingual kind of process that we had to work with. But I think it's good because I had to learn how to get everyone to understand what I was trying to do through other means than just telling them. So I had to communicate in a more multimodal way by like actually showing them, here's the sound effect, this is what I'm showing you, what I you know, we need to do. And so that was my struggle. I mean, it's hard. It was my first year in Finland. I didn't know the educational system that well, you know, so it was quite a shock. I feel a little more proficient now. But I mean, I think that's part of the learning process that I learned with the kids. We learn together how to communicate with each other.
Well, we should also remember we talk about power, and English has a very high prestige. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah.
Just a comment.
Yeah,
thank you.
True. That's
So one of the aspects I like about the video, it was the discursive genres that are involved. So I think it shows that children have this repertoire of genres, and they use them to create meaning, no, in that space. So I think it's an opportunity for making the teachers aware, yeah, of how powerful is it, because they use the news, mm-hmm, no, yeah, that it needs a form, a discursive genre, right? Yeah. But also drama, also filming. So maybe looking at this multimodal artifact through the genre, yeah, the genres that were involved, and how together articulate something. Well, it's an idea for.
No, and I think that's really good, because when you notice what the puppet is, and it was that's the evil. And suddenly you get like what they chose to highlight as to, because they had the aims, they didn't have to add those sound effects, but they chose to do that, you know, is the genre of, you know, with fantasy and alien, you have that expectation that this is what the kind of, you know, it won't just be a straight dialogue between, you have to have those sound effects in the background, which is very true. Okay. Yeah. And then, I think last question, then we...
Okay, first a comment, or I want to say how it is in Germany, and then also a question. In Germany, it's the same situation. The teachers are under a lot of pressure, and they don't want, when you approach a school and they don't know you yet, then they will say, oh, but we have so much to do. You have to really get the principal on board. Because he knows which teachers maybe are willing to participate in such projects, and also you have to make it look as little work as possible, yeah, for, yeah, the teachers. Yeah. And but so it's really good if you have a long-standing relationship with the school and the teachers, and you know they have to have the feeling they also benefit from this. And also, I think it's important that this kind of projects are also sustainable. That's what I wanted to ask. You made this project with the film, but what happened afterwards?
Well, we're continuing it because it's different sessions, and so we're going to come back to the preschool primary again. Yeah, we've been working in the community center of that of Keltamaki, of that area. So we've been working with a lot of the same kids on in other aspects of it, still in contact with teachers. It's still maintained. And next year, we're going to go back and do some more stuff. Include that. Thank you. To Lindsay.
She's got the finished one.
This one. Okay. Wait, I do have the English. I'm pretty
that I have actually I translated have. This. Okay. Just Google Translate.
That's Al Gareth there.
Oh,
yeah.
There we go. And please be the... Just check.
It's the English.
It's the English. Yay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. And he says to kind of, if you can, to talk into this or the mic.
Okay. And I move forward by pressing these?
Yes.
Okay. So, hello, hi, thanks for having me, Nessie.
Great.
I'm going to just talk through a few methodological and dissemination processes that I've been involved in. Given what we've spoken about this morning, I wish I'd focus slightly more on my work with children, given it is education. But I thought I would have a sort of quick whistle-stop tour through a few different techniques. So I'm going to have a look at some dissemination techniques. I think we're all probably quite used to this idea of arts-based approach to dissemination. So it's a bit more of a traditional look at some of that work I've been involved with. And this is with CODES, the project I worked on before I moved to MMU, which is the Centre on Dynamics of Ethnicity in Manchester University. So I'll have a look at some graphic pictorials that we pulled together from local inequalities work that I was doing for the last number of years. Also, I'm just going to touch on something that I was only very briefly involved in, which was the Little Book of Answers, which is work done with Laura Mellicart and Bridget Byrne, my former colleague, working with Young Identities, a Manchester-based spoken word collective. Now, I cannot take credit for either two of those. It's something that I just worked with some people to develop or be the kind of academic involved in it. But it really is both of their work, and I'm going to point out maybe some of the problems that sometimes academics appropriating others' creative abilities and sort of adding kind of colour to our work, and maybe how, yeah, it's not always so great as well. It looks nice and it's a nice thing for the report and it has a nice, you know, I have some nice visuals here, and it's very helpful for presentations like this because it makes it seem as though I'm creative when I'm really not. So just to sort of think about the ethical issues there. I spent a long time doing research with children directly. That's my background, and I thought I'd touch on some the least adult technique. I know that many of you will know this, least adult research, and in retrospect maybe I should focus more on that, but we can talk about it in questions. And from my work in CODE and now in MMU, I have a migration and families network, and I'm just going to touch very briefly on that. That's much more statistical at the moment, so I'm not sure how much interest it is, but I thought I would mention it. So my background is I'm primarily started in Children's Research Centre, which is a developmental psychology and social work research centre on children. Was very influenced with the work of Sheila Green, who was very much about a child-centred methodology and really wrote some of the great books on that. I moved on to look at immigration into Ireland, which of course at the time seemed, or was, quite innovative. Ireland's not known as a country where many people chose to move to, but a country that people moved away from, was the way in which we tend to think about migration until relatively recently. But that does not mean that there was a homogeneity in what being Irish was or Irish people were. And we have to be very careful about those stories, collective narratives about who the Irish people are, because it's been a much more complex, a very deliberate national process of developing who we were. So I'm not saying Ireland was a homogenous country at all, but in terms of that very obvious or overt immigration into the country, it was not till the early 90s, 2000s, that really started. And the Trinity Immigration Initiative was a big project looking at that migration from many different strands. And we had great ideas. We were going to do wonderful, interesting research, and then the IMF comes into the country and it all just seems a little bit like it's not going to work out. So a lot of us moved on from that work. I moved to the UK and then started working the Centre on Dynamics of Ethnicity, which was a big research project once again, but looking at ethnic inequalities. So looking at this, how do inequality and racism contribute to how we think about ethnicity or cultural identities in the UK. This is a very problematic term. A lot of the differences that we see amongst communities, sometimes there is a tendency to draw on cultural narratives when really we're talking about inequality in the labour market, we're talking about inequality to healthcare systems, we're talking about inequality in terms of transport and housing very particularly. So CODE had a remit to look at that, and we used a lot of quite interesting statistical data to chart this from the end of the Second World War to the present day. And we also did four ethnographic case studies looking at historic centres of migration and also ethnic mixing, whatever that may mean. Four hubs in the UK, which were Govan Hill in Glasgow, Butte Town in Cardiff, the London Borough of Newham, and Cheetham Hill in Manchester. And I went around the country interviewing lots of different people and spending time with them. And from that work, you may know then, there was a Tory majority government. They decided they would end the call for the SRC research centres, which CentCode was then a part of. So I've had two situations in a row where funding has ended unexpectedly. I don't know, maybe it's me. Code continues on in some sense at the moment, but with time for us to move on, I've now moved to MMU gladly. And myself and my former colleague Kitty Limpurapulu have continued this Migration and Families Network. We felt at the time in Code was a great project, but there wasn't a focus on the racialisation narratives of migration, which they happen today. We know in the UK, although it's hard, we don't keep talking about people of minority backgrounds in terms of migration. When do you stop being a migrant? You know, if your great-grandparents are the person who moved, are you still defined by migration? But yet, at the same time, we know there, these narratives of migration have a racialisation effect. I think Debbie Weeks-Bernard and Omar Khan wrote a very nice piece on why this is still about us, why my narratives around migration are still directed at people of minority backgrounds, even though they may be here for many generations. So we wanted to have a much more overt look at migration, especially around families. Okay. So I've already mentioned that we spent about 2 years interviewing people, primarily policymakers in the first round, NGOs, local, national, regional governments, religious community groups and residents. Interestingly enough, not education professionals, although there was education policy did become a part of this discussion on interculturalism or their particular practice of how they like to see integration, this sort of very, let's not look at the economic inequalities involved, but let's just draw on kind of cultural narratives to bring people together. So there was this, education was brought, but it was less overt in this work. So from these masses of interviews that we developed, and we're all that work is coming out now. As you know, qualitative research is a little slower to come out than the great quantitative work that came out of Code. There were many sort of interesting narratives of racism, categorisation, institutional racism, Islamophobia. And we got a little bit of impact funding. So impact, whatever that may mean, to work with artist Paul Gent. You may have noticed, I think it's become a little bit of a thing to have an artist draw live pictures of you while you're in a conference, and this picture of you like, and you know, yes, I have a great idea, and you're like, oh, that's fantastic. Yes, I look very intellectual. So Paul is the absolute master of that, you know. So we had lots of pictures of us all in meetings, like thinking hard. So we asked him, would he be involved in trying to come up with some sort of postcards, some visual conceptualization of our data from the local inequalities work. So we worked with him, and he came up with these interesting depictions of the data. And we, as researchers, we pulled out some data. Now, this was after the fact that we had interviewed these people. This had all been written out. We had verified the scripts. You know, this is not co-production with the residents themselves. This is very much after the fact. So we selected out what we thought we would work. We sent him a lot of that data, and Paul was able to kind of visualise it and give it a... Yeah, and I think an impactful visual representation. And these are put onto postcards. So in this one, he's talking about the categorization of ethnic and regional categories you might know in the UK. We fill out these, you know, categories all the time, and there's a lot of problems with those categories. They're very much an imagined idea of kind of racial and national conflation of categories. White Irish is included because white Irish people lobbied to be included. We wanted that ethnic category included. Other people are included because they're seen as somewhat suspect communities, and they want to monitor the numbers of people in the UK, you know, based on them. So it's a very political process about how and if you're included in these ethnic categories. And also there's a huge problem, you know. I just come from a country where I was looking at immigration into Ireland and this idea of Irishness, and now suddenly to be in the UK, to be Irish was only to be white. These two things were, linked. So my own family and people that I knew could never, identify as Irish in the UK because you've got this very much of this linking. So it's a story, it's an imagined identity in statistical form, and you have to remember that. So this is many of our residents speaking about this. So why should you put other? Because to me, other is really derogatory. So again, if you don't fit into any of these categories, you're then other. So this is some of these people speaking. So we talked about ethnic and regional categories, institutional racism and education. Again, a sense going to certain schools in the UK that, you know, the aspiration to achieve a certain level of educational qualification was not encouraged. You know, I think there's a lot of questions around aspiration now. It's been, well, if we just aspire enough, we can achieve anything we want to be. We know that's, also wrong. I don't want to play into those narratives either. But again, this young man who was a taxi driver kind of pointing out that he was never sort of encouraged in his dreams by teachers and by career guidance people. So the Islamophobia postcard. Again, these are put onto postcards and up on our website and sent out to policymakers, available at our conferences. So we are having to justify ourselves just because of a few mad nutters out there. This is a representation of Bute Town, Cardiff. Cardiff is a very interesting area. It was a huge port. Many sailors from all over the world, especially from Somalia, set up home in Cardiff and have lived there for many generations, and sort of lived as quite a mixed race community. It was mostly men who came from Somalia, had a very long, well-established Muslim identity, very mixed identity, and had then sort of had a very long lag with no one else joining them, and then suddenly a new wave of Somali immigration has started in that area. And there's been tensions around Islam, as there has been in many parts of the world. So I suppose the point being that many people had lived in Cardiff for probably about 200, 300 years. It's a very old, established part of Cardiff. So all of these new narratives playing in here. So Paul very, I think, nicely captured that in this postcard here. Community relations and migration, once more, capturing some of the data we had here. He said to me, some of the Somali community don't say hello to me. And I've turned around and said, well, you do say hello to them. Things have changed totally now. We're the new migrants who come here from, you know, Somalia or wherever, Yemen, and they stick to their own communities. So this is talking about these community relations, how there was this older group of migrants, or not migrants, of course, Somali population, or of many generations ago in Cardiff, and tensions between this old and new understandings of what this identity meant. One of the big themes that pulled out of our work was a sense of nostalgia and the danger of nostalgia. That many of these areas had really long social issues of deprivation. They were poor areas. There was a lot of pulling of funding, a lot of infrastructural decline because of central and regional governments, non-investment in these areas over a very long period. So there were areas in which there was quite historic issues and violence. And this was a representative we talked to in Glasgow, talking about, you know, that these areas are now racialized in terms of, well, this is a really dangerous area because many Roma live in this area and this is the issue. But sort of saying, well, there's a really long history to violence in this area, but the point is, you know, well, it's fine if it's just a Glasgow stabbing, an old traditional Glasgow stabbing, but, you know, you don't want Roma migrants, like, eating seeds in the streets. This is a kind of nostalgia that people don't, the violent, it's, there's a racialized discourse around things that are really about economic inequality and lack of services and the, for a very long time, the ignoring of certain areas in preference for gentrification of other parts of Glasgow. Yeah, this is a very complicated postcard, and I'm not sure all the postcards are equally as impactful, so it's something to kind of keep in mind. But again, in talking about equalities legislation, there's been a movement in the UK to stop talking about racism. We don't talk about race and racism anymore. It's just everybody, you know, should be thrown in with sort of an equalities hat. It's all about equalities now. We don't want to do anti-racism work. Let's not mention racism. There was a conception that we were post-racial at one point. A lot of policy makers pointing out the problems around equalities legislation and how this has silenced the voice, especially of NGO groups who set up as a really anti-racist organisations. This is really prevalent in London. Around the time, a lot of organisations would have set up in the anti-fascist movement. There was a big rise of the BNP at one point. Many of them had this history in anti-racist work, monitoring the police, making sure that, yeah, attacking, I suppose, those kind of acceptability of race and racism that had taken a seed in some local government at the time, and they had maintained their legacy from that point, but had really been closed down very recently under the mantle that you're not fulfilling all of these equality legislation, you know, it needs to be focused on all different aspects and not just race. Newham had, I think I'll just skip through this one. But yeah, Newham trying to rebrand itself as the Olympic borough and sort of forgetting about its population, how they were ring-fenced away. We may remember the London Olympics as this wonderful expression of multicultural Britain, but the reality of people who lived in Newham were kept at arm's length from that Olympic village, and the housing that was built in terms of the athletes' village was meant to be for local housing in that borough, but it has never really come to pass. And this was a youth worker that I interviewed. He was a youth worker of Muslim background. And he was talking about how he had come back from a youth work conference abroad and just talking about this border control and how they would treat him. So he talks at quite length. He talks about an amusing way that he came through to border control one time, and he had some very young, naive security people beginning to interview him. And they were so new to the job that they forgot what questions they should ask. So because he was a youth worker, he sort of helped them out. He was like, okay, well, you should ask me this, and what about this? And they're like, oh, thanks, yeah, that's, you know, wonderful. So I try to capture that. I'm not sure it's completely, that point comes completely a point. This is what he's actually said to me. What does that, you read this. So the postcards are nice, like they look nice, and I can see why the presentation looks impressive because of all these pictures in it. But I'm not sure the actual humour or irony necessarily comes across here. It does, but he's sort of pointing out that it's this really weird situation in which there's these horrible kind of power dynamics going on, which are weird for him. In that, to a certain extent, he feels so much empathy for these young guys. He's a youth worker. He's used to that, helping, especially young men, find their voice. But he's put in this very vulnerable and horrible sort of situation, having to justify himself all the time. So there is there's difficulties in that. So some of the benefits, there's lots of literature on this, but I think academics are very good at identifying problems. It's our sort of, that's what we do. We people who go, that's wrong, you haven't thought about it from this angle. I'm sure I'll be told many, I'll learn lots from everybody pointing out what I have mistaken as well. And Paul was very much schooled in a different way. Designers are very, he's very good at identifying solutions. So his way of working was to identify solutions constantly. So we were pointing out problems, he was sort of designing or trying to work through that. So I thought that was an interesting match-up. I think working with designers would be really useful in many different ways, because I'm not sure academics are ever good at coming up with a solution, but we're good at identifying the problems. Paul was very obviously able to visualise things in a way we couldn't. We cooperate and compromise in several drafts, so I think some are more successful than others, some may be overloaded with detail, and probably that's a problem of the academics saying, no, you need to include this, and this is a really good phrase, and why don't you put that in? But some are less readable or less impactful, I think. It's a much faster process than writing reports or academic papers, and there's something to be said from that. Just speed. Qualitative especially is very slow. I worked with a lot of quantitative. I have a little quantitative background, but not that much. They already have that data. Qualitative is a slow process. And I've been able to reuse them for my own teaching. I think that it's teaching or talking about race and racism to students is very awkward. They don't really like to talk about it. And things like that are a good talking point. So they have been useful. Drawbacks, as you'd imagine, the stories need to be neatly conceptualised. We didn't co-produce these postcards with the residents at all. It was an overthought. It was not something that we ever went back to them about. So that's a very problematic aspect of this. Yeah, the academics are focused on nuance. The artists on impact and clarity. And they really came too late, I think. CODE lost its funding soon after. There was plans to use this sort of work, or keep working with Paul to use them more widely in education materials. But the nature of the beast is, even if the project continues on, the people who are involved in that project have to move on for their lives. You know, they can't do it for free. So a lot of that team that was built up has sort of dissipated at the moment. Another project I was part of was with my former colleague Bridget Byrne. And as you may know, she's written a lot on citizenship and the construction of what it is to be British, those narratives that come from this test that you need to do, which is quite common in many countries now. that there's a construction of knowledge about what it is to be Briton, and you must pass that test to get your citizenship. So she's written extensively about that, and an artist, Laura Malacart, came on board or approached Bridget Byrne directly and said, can I use that work to develop her own book, which is called The Little Book of Answers, which is about the answers to the citizenship test, poetry, musical score. This, what do we mean? What is this creation or story around Britain that is institutionalised in this test? And she had this exhibition that went around the country and in Manchester. And I had just, I was involved with just bringing in Young Identity, a Manchester-based spoken word group, to be a part of that exhibition. I don't have a huge amount to say about that, other than they were a lovely group to work with. There was a real lesson in the power of language. If you want to know the masters of the sentence, the masters of a word, you need to work with spoken word artists. They're incredible. Our tortured academic work, in which almost the readability can be destroyed in the torturousness of that. You know, working with someone who is a poet, and especially a slam poet, is a really interesting experience about how much they're able to craft that language in this amazing way. However, bringing them in, it felt a bit tokenistic. There was the kind of artists who bring colour to the event, and I think all the team were aware of this. This is just my critique. We launched this event, bringing in spoken word artists, especially from Manchester, many of whom are from minority backgrounds, you know, bringing this sense of, hey, look how great Manchester is, and we've got all this kind of hip, trendy thing going on. But they weren't like a huge part of that exhibition, not really. You know, there are issues there, I think, really. Felt a bit tacked on to the event. And the reality is it wasn't captured or uploaded onto the website, and I haven't been able to find the poetry they created for that presentation since. I can contact them directly, and maybe that's what I'll do one time. I have some videos of them. I don't know if we have time. Do you want to see? Yeah?
It's 20:30, or 20:25.
Okay, well, I can move on. I mean, I can... This is some work talking about racism, and especially... people trying to use people's words. So this is the sort of work, but not the exact. This is slam poetry events that they have in Manchester. So there, in terms of impact, I mean, easily. It's hard to go on after that and be like, well, I mean, I'm using the work of, you know. So there's this style and performance and use of powerful language. But again, how much is that brought in to sort of reflect on you? And even me putting it up now, this is ask questions. That's none of my work. It's nothing really to do with me. But there is a way in which we're using people who have these real skills to reflect well on us, and there's real ethical questions to be asked on that. So I'm not sure how much time I have now. Okay, yeah, I'll just briefly go through the least adult research. So much of the work that I've written, because the code work is just coming out now, was on children in Dublin, children from many different backgrounds who'd lived in Dublin. And I spent 2 years in schools with them, trying to understand their little worlds and the dynamics and friendships that they developed. I was in North Inner City Dublin, which is the area of most historic deprivation in the whole country, not only in Dublin. And we used the approach coined by Mandel called least adults, which is an approach that argues that while a researcher can never transcend their identity as an adult, they can distinguish themselves from other adult authority figures by cultivating an identity as the least mature adult of the children's acquaintance. So this generally meant that you spend an awful lot of time with children, you refrain from disciplining them as much as a problem, giving as much as possible, giving them advice or instructions. Let them call you by your first name. Spend as much time as possible with the children as opposed to teachers and staff. So it's problematic. It's meant to be. We know that there's a huge problem in research. I think we'll all talk about this today in many different ways. But the problem of the child in terms of power is even more palpable. It's a difficult process. You know, adults are those that we turn to for support and advice when we need it when we're children. They're disciplining figures. They're also, you're meant to become, in some sense, you're looking into the future. Who are you? And the idea that you can transcend that adult identity is a problematic claim. It's not only, you know, at the very least, it's wishful thinking. And worst, it's dangerous because, you know, you are an adult and you have the responsibility for collective protection of children. But there was something about this least adult technique about trying to take yourself out of the norms of adult behaviour in terms of what you do to protect your own identity, your own sense of comfort, not feeling embarrassed or shamed. In the world where you're trying to be least adult, you will not sit with the teachers in the school. You won't converse with them on how your weekend is. You will dress in a sort of very standard way, sort of similar to the children if you can, if they wear a uniform. You'll crouch down with them, you'll play games with them, you'll sometimes participate in uncomfortable activities like gossip with the children. It's an ethically difficult technique in some senses. I wish I'd brought some more. I have a working paper on this. I'm hoping to send in the next month or two for review. One thing I wanted to point out was, in this technique, the body, your body really matters. That bodily involvement in the field. To work with children, to try and, I suppose, not exactly co-producing, but the question of who you're trying to build up a relationship with, is the least adult technique is very much the children. It's not the adults. The adults end up hating you because you're a weird, strange adult who won't go into the staff room. You won't sit with them on the bus on school trips. You know, you walk with the children. You won't do any of the things that they want an adult to do. And this is very difficult and makes it a hard technique to employ. But I think it was really worthwhile. What I noticed was that my appearance, the way that I looked at the time, had a big effect on how the children interacted with me. Did I look like an academic? Had I come prepared for a meeting after school? That would have a problem for the children. I began to adopt a very uniform look, dressing in the same way. Again, it's open to a lot of criticism, like, are you trying to make yourself look like a child? No, but you're trying to take away a lot of those vestiges of authority that you may have with children to just differentiate yourself from parents or teachers. Physical activities, being willing to play chasing with kids, you know, running around the yard, crouching down on pavements, looking at little cars with them. All of these activities that they're involved in require you to, like, really be ready for it. And I was a lot younger at the time and could kind of do it. Now my back is shot, so I don't know if I'd be able to do it. But my relative youth does play a part. There's been a lot of, I think Pia Christensen has been quite critical of the least adult approach. But there is something about the relative youth of a researcher to be able to engage with very young children in these physical games and how embarrassing that is. And one example I have is that I had spent an awful lot of time with these girls in the playground, and they were very keen on playing dancing games and singing games, and I had become involved with this, doing their little dances and singing. And then they wanted to put on a show in front of the teacher, and they wanted me to be a part of the dance. And how... what do you do? You know, here is Mr... let's call him Simpson, And here is me, an adult woman, who he also finds annoying because I won't do the things that he wants me to do, putting on a dance. So, you know, I danced with the little kids. This was about a year in. I felt like I couldn't say no, but then they wanted to do a singing competition. And they asked me, you know, would you sing a song from High School Musical, was popular at the time. I was like, hey. So I sung Dancing Queen by ABBA. It was a weird moment, you know, I tried to be more professional, but I sung Dancing Queen and was given 10 out of 10, so thank you. It's the best review I've ever gotten. So, yeah, again, these are lovely little things I can add into these papers that I write and so forth, but it's those small steps. Where do you get to a point of being an adult trying to do research on racism to a point in which you're singing Dancing Queen with a bunch of children after a dance performance? And is that useful or not? Well, I wish I'd put in some of the data I was able to gather, but even understanding the ways in which young children conceptualise their world, the types of language that they use, all of that bonding experience, all of that knowledge that you just cannot get, I don't think, in any way, unless you spend that time. But also just the very essence of having to use your body in a different way, having been very embodied in that world. Well, Kant has written a lot about this, about the bodily knowledge that it takes, you know, in his famous ethnography of becoming a boxer, what it takes to be in the field and try something new. And is it, oh, this is just me talking about it. I forgot I had the slide. Yeah, so through the field or years, I took part in games of chasing, football, arm wrestling. Attempted more instances of dancing and singing, did cartwheels, built sandcastles, let the children do my hair, give me tattoos and marker, wear my sunglasses, scarves and gloves, twisted my body into uncomfortable positions to mimic their body language, sitting on curbs, it goes on. It's a non-stop physical experience. But so that's useful. It's useful for bonding. I think it helped me uncover some of the very disturbing aspects of racism that was happening in that world. Again, when we look at children, we tend to see this very idealized, innocent, lovely portrayal of children. It can be very easy for people to say, oh, well, if we could only be all like the children, they don't see differences. It's like the children really see differences and they're terrible to each other. So, you know, taking that much more messy, but also all of these little, I know, as we would probably term it, microaggressions, these really subtle and everyday aspects of racism and how they were inculcated. I found very much, particularly in sports, how they were racialized in sports. But the very process of doing and being physical in that environment has its own knowledge in itself. As I said, well, Quant talks about this a lot. Merleau-Ponty has pointed out, and I like his work quite a lot, about the body. To learn to see colours is to acquire a new way of seeing, a new use of one's body. It is to recast the body image. Whether a system of motor or perceptual powers, our body is not an object for I think, it is a grouping of lived through meanings. So there is a power there's something worthwhile in that physical sense to understand what that world is or to get a glimmer of what it is to be in that child in that world. This physical sense, this vulnerability of being seen, of moving throughout the world and what it means in that children's world. So just trying to experience that. Again, I'm not saying I was a child. I'm not saying that I really completely accessed something, was accepted into a child or really experienced what that childishness is. But there's something to be said about not being the static person on the outside, just looking people and trying to take notes, but being involved in it and the knowledge that brings. Okay, I'm very briefly just I'm not going to spend long on this because I can talk about it later. But there was an issue in which migration had been left out of the story of Code. And myself and Kitty Limpurapulu, who is a fantastic quantitative social scientist, have Now, we set up a conference in 2017, which was very well attended, with policymakers and key academics. And we've brought them together under this website, which has a forum built into it. It's an integrated forum where you can upload and download information that NGOs and many different groups can participate in, as well as academics. So we've had three children between us since we've done this, myself and Katie, both moved institutions. So it's been slow enough, but it's beginning to pick up speed once more. And the aim is to co-produce, especially policy, and use research that many NGO groups have themselves, because many of them don't need us to come in and do fresh research for them. Like, the last thing an NGO needs is like, hey, I've come along and I have this project and can you find participants for me, you know, and I might give you, you know, because I said, hey, we already know this. We have loads and loads of data. Nobody is willing to look at it. So we want the network to be this way in which some of this work can come through. And maybe some of the things that they are missing are access to statistics and statistical backup. And that's something that we can present. Katie was the key author in these policy briefings we did for CODE, which were very successful looking at census briefings. At the moment, we're working with the think tank in MMU, Metropolis, putting blog posts, and we're doing an event in Westminster in 2019. We have a special issue on methodology, a proposal with migration studies that's specifically looking at quantitative methodologies. We're starting a new series of policy briefings, and we're co-producing a policy briefing with Greater Manchester Immigration Unit. So we've had the initial meetings with Amanda Shaw there, looking at the potential of Brexit on children. Using the Understanding Society data set at the moment, which is an ethnic boost sample that hasn't properly been utilised, I think, in relation to family research. So we'll probably chat informally about Brexit. Will it ever end? I think for many of us, I'm not going to be able to speak for the whole of everyone who lives in the UK. I can only speak for someone who is a EU migrant, but also an Irish person who was talking endlessly about, does anyone realise there's a border? You know, it's your border. It's actually nothing to do with the Republic of Ireland, but, you know, all of that peace process is underpinned by, I think it's like 300 articles of European law. So you just want to undo all of that. So whatever your political viewpoint, there's a lot of problems there. So the network at the moment is focusing on the legacy of, or what may happen with Brexit, but because it's such a slippery beast, I think none of us can really get a handle on what the shape of it's going to be, what's the outcomes going to be. And it's a little bit of a waiting game. So we do know that if we revert back to some of the migration legislations that's happened for people who are not EU, there's been some really regressions in policy there. So the minimum income threshold to bring non-European spouses to Britain, Rule 317 on dependent parents, you now cannot bring in your parent to the UK even if you can show that you can completely support all of their needs. They cannot be brought into the UK unless they are, and I not know, this isn't hyperbole, but unless they're literally dying, you cannot bring them to the UK. So even, it used to be the case if you can show that they're, your parents will not be a drain on Britain and you have permanent right to stay, that you can bring in your parent, but you can't do that anymore. So we will be going back to those rules if there's no, we don't know what the situation will be. Yeah, it's regulatory alignment with Ireland, family reunification, and really wider ethnic inequalities. So again, not looking at necessarily always culture, but inequalities that have happened. And I'll leave it there because I've talked for a long time and we can talk about this later.
Sorry, I thought you wanted to speak, but you're just... Okay.
Thank you.
The one with the mic.
I see. Thank you. Thank you. I mean, that was really interesting, really engaging. I had a question and a comment, so my comment will sort of depend on your response to the question. Looking at the postcards that you did, you mentioned as you were speaking that some of them were more or less impactful. Can you just describe what you mean by impactful? What kind of impact were you hoping for?
Yeah, I'm probably using that in its descriptive sense of the word rather than a quality I can neatly summarise. I think they got a good uptake. When they were sent out, they were something that people tended to like. Now, like by tweeting them, you know, how do you really measure what they were used for? They seem, for instance, this seemed to be a very successful, this was one that was tweeted quite regularly. It has a very clear central figure. I think Paul wanted to represent this woman almost like, I don't know, a Statue of Liberty type figure, someone who is very centrally in the middle of the picture, a sort of powerful individual who speaks for a community, if that's maybe problematic or not, but had this very, hero pose or something was the way that he wanted to describe it. It has, I think, key quotes that work quite well, and has this text kind of conceptualizing it for that's quite concise and well thought out. So it was one that we have to remember that most people, and myself included, are lazy readers. We don't want to read through the detail. We want what is going to pull out at us quite quickly, and we're only going to read on if it's really of interest. So this got a lot of uptake. I think it's a visually strong image, and the writing worked really well for it. I think some of the others are too text-heavy. For instance, I think this is an incredibly text-heavy postcard, and it's almost hard to see what's going on because the writing is all over it. And, yeah, I think it could have been reframed better. It didn't get as much uptake, and I think it's a, was sad because it's actually talking about legislation and policy, and it's something that I would have preferred that got a lot of, not preferred, but I would have liked to have seen it be taken up more, because we're trying to reach policymakers, and if we're talking about equalities legislation and so forth, haven't, you know, been properly, it's been problematic, let's say, the way it's been framed, at the very least, to throw everything into this one equalities framework. But I think just it didn't work, and I think it's a problem of the academics just trying to put in too much. Or to say, you need to put this in, and put this in. I think Paul wanted to represent it differently. So it may work, you know, we may like it, but in terms of just them repeated or getting any feedback on it, it was one of the least. You can even just see the Equalities Act is just represented as this. Lost in the visual, as it were. So I'm not sure if I have any hard facts on how impactful it was. Like I said, Code sort of finished up at the end, very closely after these were released. So they may have been more uptake if we had more resources to push them. But I think there is something to be said with the visual between this and this. That there's just a sort of a problem there. So I think taking the advice of the artist, you know, really letting go sometimes of the details. And it's not always, you know, Kate's often said to me that it's not, you know, you have to, it's not necessarily the way the academics would like to frame things, you know, if you're working with people. But again, this is co-production with an artist. It wasn't with the people themselves. So you feel like, well, you have to represent what the people said.
Yeah.
So you feel like you have to be the voice for them. The artist is not someone who's coming to you with that detail. So it's a weird, where is the co-production layer there? But certainly designers have a better sense, I think, of what's going to get through to people. So.
I was thinking when you were saying some were more impactful and some were less, I was assuming the same as what you've just said, really. So the postcards with the very clear message and clear images that kind of relate to archetypes that people can recognise, I can see why they would be impactful, and the more sort of complex and complicated ones wouldn't be. And then I thought, well, I wonder if... So this one, I mean, I was reading it and I thought, you know, I don't really know what the message is here. Like, I don't know what this kind of drills down to. And then it made me think, well, but yeah, maybe the oddness and the weirdness and the confusion of it is precisely the point. Yeah. And it kind of performs the same thing that's going on here, you know. And maybe... So I should say, by way of background, I'm very interested in the idea of understanding, and especially not understanding, and how productive not understanding can be. And I'd just be interested to get people's responses to this one and to see how maybe the puzzlement and the confusion it creates might be something quite productive in terms of raising questions, rather than having a quite neat encapsulation of something that is really complex and contradictory and weird. And you know what I mean?
I think it's really important, and it's a really good point. You know, I think there is something about, the process, rather than just the impact. I think the issue is even getting people to engage in that process, though, is some of the difficulty.
Yeah, definitely,
now,
yeah.
We were going to do an actual graphic novel, the thing people trying to outline all of those, and I think something had been done after I left, but sort of the impetus had sort of waned a little bit. But I think there's something really key in what you're saying there, that it is about, because it's not a simple message. Trying to simplify it is a lot of the problems in this work. You know, we want to simplify, oh, the problem, you know, of racism is this. You know, if people would just, you know, go to a community event and, you know, play a game, you know, then it will be solved. It's like, well, no, it's very complicated. There's a complicated backstory to this. So I'm not sure how... I think it's good to work through it, but trying to even get people to try and work through it is kind of a problem.
I wonder if, like, as academics, I think there's a kind of urge to explain, isn't there? You know, we're teachers, we want to explain stuff. And maybe that effective response of just, what is going on here? I don't understand.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the thing that communicates, maybe.
It's a very good point. I like the way you framed that.
Yeah. Thank you.
I was really interested, Lindsay, in your account of taking up... I would say that was taking up the position of a child as a researcher, because we've got a similar project on our odd... We've got this project called Feeling Odd in the World of Education, which one of our researchers became a child, and it was a very challenging thing to do, and I think it would be really interesting to hear more about the kinds of things you learned in that position of a child that you wouldn't learn in different ways. So I guess... I just wanted you to talk more about that, because I just found that really interesting.
Yeah, it was a very interesting and very challenging for me. Like, I think we probably all have the experience of doing some research that sort of lives with you in your dreams, you know, that you feel like, oh, man, like, it had a bit of a weird impact on you, and that, I certainly felt that from this research. So... I spent a long time there, two academic years, working with children in several schools, and primarily with one class at the end. And some of the things that, for instance, some of the things that came clear for me, I have an example I wish I'd put in now, about a child throwing up a ball. They're in one of these playgrounds that we had. I should go back. When we were talking earlier about children have very little control over their lives and so forth in school, I think we're sort of forgetting about the informal aspects of the school. The formal day is very well structured, but there's a whole informal world in schools. The Dymphna Divine is called, you know, the backstage of the school. I've kind of called it the child world as a school, although that's a problematic term in itself. But there's all these informal little things that are happening, even within structured lessons.
little bits of body communication, small things like where you place your pencil case on the desk, like what does that mean in school, like, you know, going up to pair your pencil at the bin, like undermining the teacher, taking a really slow time to do it. All these small little things that you, from the outside, don't look like anything. You can't understand what does this mean, but even a kind of notice, you know, putting your pencil cases slightly into someone's space is a way of sort of intimidating them. All these small little narratives that you begin to understand as you work with children. So I spent a long time just working with them then in that that much more obviously informal space, which was the playground, running around with them the whole time. And I could tell one instance, I'll just give you kind of an example to make it more tangible. I knew that there was something not work. There was a strange interaction around one child who was born in Ireland, but his parents were from Nigeria. And I knew that there was tension there, and there had been sort of, as we had talked informally, lots of different tension going on. And there was a covered area of the playground, so most of the area was split up into children playing sports and games, usually football. And then there was another area which was slightly covered over. It was called the shed area. And I knew that this little boy didn't like to go into that shed area. And it was kind of, you know, you kind of can think, oh, well, what's going on there? So I had been playing with the boys for a long time, and one time a ball went up on top of this shed, and I climbed up this pillar and took down the ball, which was, again, a calculated move to undermine my my kind of identity as an adult, you know, and I got reprimanded for the teacher to do it, so for doing it, you know, for self-help and safety, and, you know, there's programmatic elements for me trying to be a bit cheeky and stuff. But because I had very obviously put myself kind of against the teacher, who kind of gave out to me, so I was a naughty child myself, they brought me to the backstage of this shed area, and I could see that there was all this racist, like, words all etched into the shed area. And it was kind of a covered area. Now, I felt really guilty, like, did it put me into a sense of the children thought I was one of them, would participate in this racist name-calling. But it sort of, there was this whole backstage of the school, all of this racist graffiti that had been targeted towards this child, which was quite hidden. It was sort of hidden around this corner at the level of the children, straight in. So you'd have to kind of, you'd have to use your body to get down and see it. It wouldn't be obvious to an adult. So that kind of unlocked some of the series of racism that was going on in that class. And that's a very obvious example. So, you know, finding racist graffiti, when you write an article, it's really easy to sort of say, well, this is racism. But there was much more subtle forms of microaggression against this child on a constant basis, usually framed in terms of you being rubbish at football, this idea that they're framing as rubbish at football. And this was like some sort of neutral thing in which they were slagging him off for, but it wasn't neutral at all. It was very much racialized and fitted into narratives around masculinity, especially from a North Dublin perspective, which we can talk about later. They had these really racializing and nationalist kind of associations with it. But it was only with spending a very long period of time I could kind of understand these small things, like constantly picking him up for like throwing the ball in wrong, or using his feet wrong, or, you know, that everything about him was wrong, was not simply a kind of trying to improve him as a sportsman, if you know what I mean. There was this whole racializing discourse. But I can't say that I ever became a child, but it's that, obviously I didn't become a child, I was an adult woman, but that whole experience of trying to differentiate yourself from children was important. And I have never been a teacher, and I wasn't a parent at the time, so there was something about that life stage in which I was in that I think allowed or facilitated that more, that I wasn't coming at children in that same way. I had been a researcher of children
for a few years beforehand. So I think it would be more helpful if I had brought those examples, but hopefully the paper will be out soon enough. But yeah, and unlocking that, then I was able to bring that into those interviews. So instead of having these structured, semi-structured interviews where I would decide what the questions to be asked were, we had more informal chats where I could ask certain questions. So I'd seen instances or behaviours on the playground. So I could ask obscene, very neutral things like, oh, I saw you scored a goal in football the other day, but someone else said that wasn't a goal. What happened there? And then you would get this whole big backstory about all of this racism that, you know, you just wouldn't have accessed any other way. There would be no way of asking a key question to unlock all of these small, yeah. Anyway, sorry, I could go on forever.
It's just that there's a class coming, so we have to.
Yeah.
So, Greta has a lunch thing for you, and it's way over there.
Yes. So, everyone with a tag, please come here and have your lunch ticket. And
apologies that we have to cut it, but we actually gone over.
Sorry, my apologies.
No, I'm not a bad person.